And then I welcome you all up again. Thank you. You can stay here. And then also Annika, Sundén and Mimi Söderberg. And I ask you, Annika, if you can start making some comments and pose a question, and then Mimi, then it's a free discussion and focusing on important areas and also on the policy relevant issues. And then, of course, I invite also the public and the audience here. But you can start, Annika. Mm.
So thank you very much for very interesting dissertations and presentations. I'm the chief economist at CEDA and works broadly with development. So I'm, of course, very curious about if you could elaborate a little bit. You were talking about your policy implications, but if you all could elaborate a little bit on them and what advice would you give to somebody working in development cooperation? What should agencies like CEDA do to address the problems that you put forth in your dissertations? That's one question. Another question that I have that also goes over all your fields or subjects is if you put your subject or what you've studied within the framework of the whole state, of the country, how much of your results, or how would you frame your results in respect to how well the state is functioning, how well state institutions are functioning? And I'm thinking, if you take your dissertation about the participation in constitution writing, what are the effects, or how much impact has strong institutions already and the strong political will to build a democratic society? So if you could put your results in the context of the state, I would be interesting to hear that.
Excellent. I'm going to start with making a comment. My name is Mimi Söderberg-Kovacs, and I was previously at the Department of Peace and Conflict Research at Uppsala University and at the Nordic Africa Institute, and just recently took on the policy hat and are now working at the Folke Bernadotte Academy as head of research. So I have two of my former colleagues standing here. I wanted to make one point first about this. I think this is an excellent initiative to do these things, and I've been thinking a lot about, as head of research, and with the role of integrating research and policy making, what can research bring to policy? And one of the things that I think you all address head on is to say that there are all these assumptions out there in the policy world about how things connect, what are the causal chains. And there are weaknesses clearly in many of the theories of change that we all work with in the policy world. And I think what you all do, and what I think we should do all the time, is to strengthen our analysis and our arguments about why we do the things we do and how one thing is expected to lead to something else. And I think you all do that excellently. You kind of address that head on and work specifically with sort of breaking down that sort of assumption of change, which I liked a lot, I have to say. I think that's a fantastic way of getting how we can use research in the policymaking world. And I have a number of specific questions to different authors, but I think we'll start with your overall questions about the policy relevance more generally, and then we follow up on more specific questions.
Perfect. Who wants to come?
Okay, I can start since I'm going to start by restating a recommendation that have been said so many times, but I think that it's has to be restated again, and that is that you really need to understand what you are doing. Good understanding enables good solutions, and I've seen that over and over again in both Sudan and South Sudan, that the international community don't have a clue of what they are doing. And for instance, I was at a conference that Friedrich Ebert Stiftung had in Juba, and it was 15 South Sudanese there, and they were very proud that they had a large representation of the South Sudanese society. However, when I talked to a friend that had worked there for several years, they were all from the exact same family. They had one contact person there, and he had invited his friends. And this is just one example. I think that this is seen over and over again. So that, and when it deals to communal conflict, it happens that projects are launched in such a way that they don't understand what condition will happen between the different communities. And regarding the issue of the state, I just returned from Khartoum, where we had a big discussion about this. And I think that the weak state, the entire approach is very strange, I think, because it's what does that mean? It's so broad, so it's very difficult to understand it. And in the case of Sudan, I would say that the state is fairly strong in a lot of senses. They have been in power for almost 30 years now. So you have a strong state, but you have a weak society. And you have the institutions that we want to be strong, they are weak. But the institutions that we want to be weak, such as the military and the security services, are strong.
I think that in terms of participation by the public in constitution building processes, being a policy recommendation, I don't think that this should be the default answer, which it is right now. I'm quite aware that there are international advisors at this point telling governments in post-conflict contexts that you have to include the people, you just have to. And whereas the governments are saying, you know, we just can't because there's no resources for it and there's no, you know, the security environment doesn't allow it, but international actors are still propagating that this is what you should do. And I think that, which goes to what Yuan was saying, you need to listen to people who are actually working in these countries and who are living in these countries. I think that in terms of any, I don't like to give general advice, but I think that there is still a point in gradually opening up the process for public participation if you want to do it. I mean, looking at the cases that I've looked at in my dissertation and just looking at the most recent case of Tunisia, for example, when political elites together reach consensus on some of the most pressing and most sensitive issues to begin with and then include the public, I think that there is a better chance for less polarization and things like this. So in terms of a general recommendation, I would perhaps... Yeah.
This is exactly what I was after, sort of under what circumstances would it work? I mean, could you... I mean, you're all pointing to that the context matters, of course, but so you need to draw out then in what situations and what conditions need to be fulfilled for it to...
Exactly.
I think that's what I was sort of getting at, in terms of other institutions, what has to work for this to be successful.
I mean, looking at my cases, I mean, it's political will at the end of the day. I mean, even though you have a broad-based public participation and you have even conducted constitutional education programs, because, I mean, constitutional issues are quite difficult. I mean, for people in countries that don't have a constitutional history to get engaged in these issues and actually provide recommendations for what they think should be included in a constitution is difficult. But, I mean, even if you provide them with information, educate them on these matters, at the end of the day, I mean, the constitution has to be implemented, and for implementation, you need political will. So, I mean, that's the main thing, I think, and looking at my cases, in the cases where we have political will, the constitution is implemented quite successfully. If you don't have it, it doesn't matter how much public participation you have, frankly. So, I'm going to stop.
I think they're both, I mean, great points and really challenging. I actually don't know if For peace and conflict, that is like, what is the title? Herding cats. I think that's related to mediation. But it is a process of fits and starts and error and trial. And the tragedy, of course, is that there are lives at stake and there are human beings and who are victims of conflict. I don't necessarily believe that there is a, I know this isn't what you're saying, that give us the blueprint.
No.
That's not what you're saying.
And
I understand that. But I think that that's the sort of the tendency, particularly when you're doing research, is to think about, okay, what would be the blueprint? And if there's anything that comes out most clearly to me with the Burundi case, it's that we, as Johan was saying, we need to invest much more resources in processes and in understanding the actors much, much more clearly. I think that we are very focused on results and outcomes, but at the end of the day, CNDD-FDD has, Lennart Vogelmot is here, and he and I were talking about the fact that it was the party that was part of that was sort of the golden child of the peace agreements. And there's been massive resources invested in building peace in Burundi. And now we are sort of taking a step backwards. But if we had known a little bit more, I don't know, I'm guessing, if we had known a little bit more about the way that the internal armed group actually operated, who was financing the group, where the group was getting its recruits, how it was actually mobilizing the population, taxing the population, the fact that it was participating in violence in the region. If we had understood more, I think that would have really aided policymakers in perhaps giving more sticks. And not being so desperate for the outcome of peace, because I think that was part of the thing, is that there is this desperation for peace, and at the end of the day, if you push the process too quickly, you may end up with the wrong partners. So I think I think it is about getting to know and really, really understanding the actors, and how they're incentivized. I think under conditions where an armed group is really has incentives, and those incentives are organic and internal to the group, then you will find that they're much more willing to invest in better relations with civilians, treating vulnerable groups more carefully. And I think that kind of dependency upon the civilian population is lacking in a lot of these post-conflict societies. So from the armed group to the state institutions that don't really depend on the will of the people, and in that respect, I mean, of course, political will is the most important thing. But if you're doing development policy, you may not have as much control over political will, but perhaps trying to ensure that the processes are, I actually think that the processes should involve the people as much as possible, and that these state institutions that we're trying to build up really depend on the people inside the country. That's a very soft, sort of like vague recommendation, but it's for now the best I can do.
Thank you. As for your first question, in terms of policy implications, it's very tempting to look at one case and then sort of assume that you can do the same thing in numerous other cases. But I would say Colombia is different from these other studies insofar that the state is fairly capable and fairly strong. And perhaps that's why the international community there has been more constructive than I perceive that it has been in other countries. And specifically, it's been working as a sort of a friendly critic who's been studying funding studies of themes that were sensitive but important to know about. So they funded a study about how paramilitaries and the parliamentarians were connected. That was very important, very sensitive, and to fund that is quite brave as an outsider. They funded international monitoring missions who pinpointed when there were problems with resurgence of paramilitary groups, while at the same time supporting the state, giving them both financial support when they needed it and technical advice to play that role of both supporting and criticizing, at least in this sort of middle income countries, can be very, very effective if done correctly. And then there's numerous policy implications, but it really varies from case to case. You would need to sit down and rather...
It's difficult to generalize. It's all context specific, you're saying.
No, yeah, sure.
Since I started first, I didn't have so much time to think. So I'm taking the opportunity to say some more general recommendation. I think that the world we are living in and how we describe countries are very dichotomous. And I think that is a problem. We talk about conflicts, countries in conflict and post-conflict. So I think that we have to widen the concept of peace to understand so this is in process to larger understand the context. And we also have to widen the concept of democracy, and in particular when it comes to power sharing, because we use power sharing all the time now, but in many cases it's just to dividing the power between the two fighting actors, but it's not empowering any of the other people. So it doesn't really change anything. It's just doing the same thing. I don't know how many power sharing agreements Sudan has had, but it's very many. And when it comes to peace agreements, it's also, if the peace agreement is enforced from the outside, then the government gets their legitimacy from the international community and not from the people. So it really changed the rule of the citizens when we have that really strong enforcement mentality that has been extremely strong in the case of Sudan.
Right. I have another super difficult question, and I'm so happy to be in this role now as a policy person and not be on your side. Many of you, when you write, you come back to saying, well, by the end of the day, I'm simplifying now, it's a matter of governance, it's a matter of political leadership in these states that we're looking at, and that sort of determines the outcome. I think many of you kind of allude to that. And then my question is, the million-dollar question is, what are the implications then for a state like Sweden when we work with development cooperation? How do we truly get to that thing if we then move beyond saying, well, it's not just about supporting this program or this project out in the field, but really when it comes to working on the political level and engaging with issues about governance and political leadership, what would you recommend based on your research?
Who wants to take it? Yes, and start with that then.
I can take it and just avoid answering directly, because I deal with armed groups and not the state, and then the others who deal much more with the state. I didn't get to this in my presentation, but I do believe that there is some, I mean, it's an often used term, but there's something to be said for coordinating with other international actors. So I think Sweden, of course, has its own sort of bilateral role. It has also its own sort of role in the EU, and of course its hopeful role in the UN Security Council. But I think that coordinating the interventions from the international community is really important around specific areas. So I think it's around giving nudges and carrots and sticks and incentivizing political leadership. And particularly with conflict, you know, states that are in conflict, whether, you know, it's a small party or the state itself, I think that that, again, has to go around other sort of regimes. So the coordination of things like sanctions regimes, coordinating international mobilization, popular campaigns, supporting civil society. I mean, I know that's an assumption about supporting civil society, so I'm not sure. I'm sure a researcher has smashed that assumption. But it is to me, it does have some promise. So making sure that these things, and then of course protection of civilians, particularly because it does have an effect on things like violence against women, sexual violence, so protection of civilians, and then that coordination should be sequential. So there should be some kind of getting back to the causal logic, there needs to be some kind of causal logic. You can't just name and shame a state or a political leader without providing some kind of real incentive, some sort of, you know, so the sanctions need to be targeted at a certain point, but you can't ignore the civilians that are still living at the mercy of this political leadership. So you need to protect that civilian population. So my two cents are about sequencing and coordinating a lot of the actions that are already taking place, but need to be really much more sort of intense.
Thank you, Mimi. Very easy question. No, but I think that one important thing is to try to realize limitations and to think of maybe be more specific and try to do smaller things but be able to do them properly than to be very scattered and do very many things and none of them really works. And then to really question what have... Because a lot of things are done because they are supposed to be done. They should be there. We should have elections. Why did they introduce election in the peace agreements in Sudan? It didn't do anything good. They could have delayed that for a long time because it caused much more problem than it solved. And when dealing with the government, I think that it's also important to try to... Because, I mean, most government doesn't want to have conflict and chaos and to try to... make them to realize that and show that when you dealt with the problem in this region, it went out much better. So to try to work with them in a constructive way, and I think that it's possible in many different cases.
I think that looking at my cases, generally I would say that it's very difficult for external actors to enforce political will in other countries. I think that's a domestic issue. But what we can refrain from doing, at least, is to rush these countries when they're on board and they're saying, yes, we will do participation in constitution building, we will follow this advice, we do acknowledge that there are many benefits from it, we will have an educated citizenry who understand the constitutional rights, but can we please have more than like 3 months to do it, which was the case in East Timor? Or could we please have more than 9 months to do it, which was the case in Iraq? And can we please have more than 18 months to do it, which was the case in Afghanistan? Then we should listen and we should say, yes, you may. And not, no, you know what, we have a time schedule and this public participation needs to be done. It needs to be really fast. And I mean, yeah, there's no time for political elites to among themselves create consensus during that time period. So, yeah.
Again, looking at Colombia, this is very different. From 2002 until today, Colombia went from being almost a failed state to being a fairly strong state, going from a recipient of aid and security support to being one that sort of travels the world telling other countries in conflict how to resolve at least the reintegration. In the first phase of that, I'm not sure the international community did very much outside of military support, to be honest, which is not the answer we want to hear. But in the second phase, towards 2010 and onwards, I think it's quite notable that they've gone from asking from this classical donor recipient asking for money to fund things to much more towards technical cooperation. Traveling here to see how Swedish authorities and agencies do things in terms of learning on the technical side. I think that's been very effective, but that doesn't tell you how to get from the first phase, from the almost failed state to a decently functioning state. Yeah.
Thank you very much.